Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is Pastor Tim Warner. We're continuing in our series in the book of Acts on the ministry of the Apostle Paul, and this is going to be lesson 16. All right, last time we were in chapter 21, we covered verses 1 through 26. Now, in this section, we see that the Apostle Paul was absolutely determined to be in Jerusalem for the festival of Pentecost. And it was sort of like it was a deadline, and he was hurrying, it says, to be in Jerusalem for Pentecost. And the reason why this was so pressing on Paul's mind is if you skip back to chapter 18, it says in verse 18 that the Apostle Paul had shaved his head at Cenchrea because he had taken a vow. Now, what kind of a vow is this, right? We talked about this last week. Well, this is the Nazarite vow, which was a vow of consecration to God. And it's described in Numbers chapter 6 in detail. And basically, here's how it worked. At the beginning, when you are going to set yourself aside purely for God for a period of time, excuse me, that you determine a period of time, and at the beginning of that time, you shave your head. And then from that point on, you could not do or participate in certain things, including, you know, the drinking of wine and other things that are mentioned there in Numbers chapter 6. And so it was sort of restraining yourself or withholding certain things. Now, at the end of the time that you had vowed, let's say you vowed for a year, you vowed for 18 months or whatever it happened to be, at the end of that period, you were required to be in Jerusalem. You were required to be at the temple. And you had to bring a sacrifice. And the sacrifice is specified in number 6. One male, baby male lamb, less than one year old, and one female lamb, less than 1 year old. And one adult lamb, a ram, male lamb, a ram, and all three of these animals were to be sacrificed. Now, the Apostle Paul was coming to Jerusalem to offer up animal sacrifices in order to complete his vow. And then, as it says in Numbers chapter 6, the completion of the vow involved a 7-day process. And on the 7th day, then the animals were to be sacrificed. And at the same time, the man was to shave his head a second time. Now, this is a lot of hair because his hair has been growing from the beginning of his vow. It could be, you know, it could be a year, it could be a year and a half, it could be 2 years, it could be more. So the Apostle Paul, when he arrived there, he had very long hair. And so part of this, the ritual was to shave his head, and then while the ram, the third sacrifice, was being burned on the altar, that he was to throw this ball of hair, all of his hair that he shaved off his head the second time, he was to throw it into the fire. And that hair represented the growth from his head steadily during the entire time of his separation to God, his vow. And so it was a symbol saying that I have, during this entire time, I have kept my promise to keep myself from the things that are involved in a Nazarite vow. All right, so the Apostle Paul did that. He did it voluntarily. And now here he is in Jerusalem, and he's there to offer his sacrifice, to complete his vow, and shave off all his long hair and complete this thing. All right, offer up his sacrifices. Now, a lot of people are very disturbed, should I say, a lot of Christians are disturbed by the fact that the Apostle Paul Many years after Christ died and rose again and ascended to heaven, many years after that, here we have the Apostle Paul voluntarily participating in this ritual in the law of Moses that required animal sacrifices. You know, and that there's this impression among Western Christians that once Jesus died and rose again, that there can no longer be any valid animal sacrifices. And that's simply not true, as this passage absolutely proves. Because the Apostle Paul, and actually all of the, as we saw last week, when Paul arrived in Jerusalem, James and the elders met him, and Paul gave his defense, or he gave his report, I should say, of all that God had been doing through his ministry among the Gentiles. And then James and the others say in verse 20, you see, brother, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. So they were all, the entire Jerusalem church, myriads of Jews who had believed and become Christians, been baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of their sins, they were still participating in the rituals of the law of Moses, according to the law. And the temple was still standing, and they went to the temple, and they did the things that were required of them at the temple under the law, while at the same time being a Christian. Was this displeasing to God? Absolutely not. If it was displeasing to God, then why was Paul participating? Why was he doing it voluntarily? Why did he take a Nazarite vow, which required animal sacrifices? You know, the reason that so many Christians are under the false impression that animal sacrifices, valid animal sacrifices, cannot continue after Christ's, the ultimate sacrifice, is because they misunderstand the purpose of animal sacrifices. See, they think that animal sacrifices were sort of like a way in which God used, through the blood of animals, that God made atonement for, or they made atonement with God for sins. That is, God declared them righteous because of the atoning effect of the blood of the animals that they were sacrificing. And, they need to go back, those people need to go back and read Hebrews chapter 10. Because Paul himself says in Hebrews chapter 10, that the blood of bulls and of goats could never take away sin. So the whole point, and Paul gets into this in Hebrews, that these sacrifices were only a reminder, and they were only symbolic of the ultimate sacrifice, which was Christ. So all these rituals of the law, the Passover, when you have the lamb that sacrificed for the Passover, and they ate the Passover meal, and all the other festivals, every one of them involved animal sacrifices. But the point is that they all pointed to Christ, that they were all symbolic of Christ. They, in and of themselves, did not cleanse anyone of anything as far as sin is concerned. And so, to say that they cannot be valid for a Jewish Christian to participate in those things while the temple was still standing is foolish, because clearly the Apostle Paul did, and he was, what he was doing was indeed pleasing to God in that instance. Okay, so animal sacrifices in and of themselves are not displeasing to God when they were done with their intended meaning, that is to be symbolic and to point people to Jesus Christ, who was the ultimate sacrifice and the only sacrifice that indeed does take away sin. Okay? And in the kingdom, if you read Ezekiel, the last approximately 8 chapters of the book of Ezekiel, where the Bible describes the millennial temple, the temple in which Jesus Christ is going to sit on the throne and reign over all the earth in Jerusalem, when that city, Jerusalem, is restored. That that you know his throne is going to be there. The whole the Ark of the Covenant is no longer going to be there, because the Ark of the Covenant was a representation of God and His presence. And but Christ Himself is going to be there as the representation of God, or the representative of God, on His throne, and so He's going to rule personally from that throne. And you can see that in Jeremiah chapter 3 verses 16 and 17 if you want to look that up. It says that the one festival that's not going to be done anymore in the kingdom is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when the priests would bring the blood into the temple once a year. That festival is not going to be done anymore. It says neither shall that be done anymore. It says right there in Jeremiah chapter 3. But in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 44, where it's describing this beautiful, magnificent, and greatly expanded temple that will far surpass the temple that even Solomon built, the first temple, that that temple, Christ is going to reign from that temple. And he goes on in the Ezekiel goes on in chapters 40 through 48 to describe the festivals that are going to take place. He names specifically Passover. He names specifically Tabernacles, the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. And so we see that in the kingdom, there's going to be a new law, and it's actually the new covenant. And this new law is going to govern the festivals, as well as all the requirements. Now, it's not a reinstatement of the law of Moses, even though it shares a great many things with the law of Moses. But because Christ Himself reigns upon the throne of David in the kingdom, and He is the ultimate judge and the ultimate arbiter there, not Moses and not God from heaven, right? It's Christ Himself, the Son of God, who is going to fulfill that role, and He's going to be king over all the earth, all right? So the laws and the legal system that will be involved in the kingdom is very similar to the law of Moses, but it's not identical with it. Not only that, you'll see that the temple will be different under the law of Moses. Gentiles could not enter the temple, only Jews, only circumcised Jews. But the prophecies say that, you know, in fact, Jesus Himself said that quoting, I believe it was Isaiah, that, you know, God says, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, that is all Gentiles. Gentiles will be allowed to come to God's house, all right, to pray, even as they're uncircumcised. And there are other changes as well in the kingdom, but we don't need to get into all that. All right, so let's pick it up here in verse 27. All right, so Paul is at the temple. We saw in the previous verses here in Acts that James and the elders said to Paul, hey, you know, we see that you're here to complete your Nazarite vow, and so you have to go to the temple and offer animal sacrifices. Verse 21. But they have been informed about you that you teach the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not circumcise their children nor to walk according to the customs. And these are the customs of the law of Moses. Now, did Paul do that? Was Paul going around to the, you know, in the various cities where he was establishing churches, and, you know, he was causing splits in the synagogues, and he started these churches with a number of Jews typically at the beginning, and then added Gentiles to it. Now, the Jews who were the nucleus of the churches that Paul established, was Paul telling them to stop observing the Sabbath? Was he telling them to stop observing the festivals? Was he telling them to, you know, not eat kosher? You have to eat pork now, you know, or, you know, was he doing that? No, he absolutely not. He was not. He didn't hint in any way that Jews should stop doing those things. He simply did not require the Gentiles to do it. All right, but as you can see, they were misinformed. The crowds were misinformed about Paul, that he was telling the Jews to stop doing those things. All right, so James and the elders say to him, "What then? The assembly must certainly meet, for they will hear, excuse me, that you have come. Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. That is, they have taken a vow just like you have, Paul." And what he meant was they took a vow previously, and their vows, of four of these men, their vows were about to expire at the same time Paul's was, that is, at Pentecost. And typically when they would make a vow, they would set it for a specific period of time that would end with one of the festivals. And the reason for that was because the festivals required them to go to Jerusalem anyway, and so they would, and completing their vow would require them to travel to Jerusalem. So they combined it. It's as simple as that. All right, so he says, James says, take them and be purified with them and pay their expenses. And by that, it means to buy the animals that need to be sacrificed, so that they may shave their heads and that all may know that the things which were informed concerning you are nothing. And that was correct. All right, Paul was not doing what the people had been misinformed about. And Paul was, in fact, at least to some degree, participating in the festivals and participating in the law of Moses, and even to the point of himself offering animal sacrifices. All right, that you also walk orderly and keep the law. And I don't think that was a, I don't think James's request was asking too much. And Paul didn't think so either, because he agreed to do it. So, but concerning the Gentiles who believe, we have written and decided that they should observe no such thing, except that they should keep themselves from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. And of course, that's referring back to the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15 and the letter that was issued from that council, from James and the elders, to the Gentiles, essentially saying, you Gentiles do not need to keep the law of Moses, and you can be pleasing to God without keeping the law of Moses. All right, so verse 26, then Paul took the men, and the next day, having been purified with them, so this was the beginning of a seven-day ritual, which is described in number 6, beginning of the first day, they purify themselves, and then they, after the seventh day, that is, they were to shave their heads and then offer their sacrifice. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, having been purified with him, entered the temple to announce the expiration of days of purification. At which time, an offering should be made for each one of them. Now, as you can see, they were about to offer the animal sacrifices. It says so plainly here. Now, when the 7 days were almost ended, now I want you to notice this, that the 7 days didn't expire, which means that Paul, because he gets arrested and hauled off to prison, which means that Paul did not get to shave his head, and he didn't get to offer his sacrifices. All right, so it says, when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him. Now, what does it mean, the Jews from Asia? Well, Asia, in the Bible, Asia is Asia Minor. It's not the Far East, okay? It's Asia Minor was Turkey, particularly Western Turkey. And this is where Ephesus was. This is where a lot of the cities where Paul went from place to place was. Now, remember what happened in Ephesus. Well, the Jews at the synagogue, you know, he debated in the synagogue, and then he, you know, when they resisted him and they were blaspheming and whatnot. And so Paul takes those who believe, he takes them out of the synagogue in Ephesus. It says he separated the brethren. And he established a church. So he split the synagogue. And, you know, the Jews who were left at the synagogue, they were angry. They were angry and they hated Paul. And they thought his message was perverse and apostate. And so when they went up to Jerusalem to keep the festivals, to keep Pentecost, because, again, Jews were required 3 times a year to go to Jerusalem in person, the males were, to keep the festivals at Passover, at Pentecost, and at the Feast of Tabernacles. And so these Jews had traveled from Ephesus and from the other towns where Paul was preaching the gospel and where he had had his run-ins at the synagogues, right? They're there too. So you got Paul and no doubt many of the other brethren, Jewish Christians from the new church in Ephesus and from the other churches that Paul established that had, you know, come out of the synagogue to be part of these Christian churches. And, you know, they're there too. So you've got the Christian Jews at the temple and you've got the non-Christian Jews, those who had opposed Paul. You've got them at the temple as well, having all traveled from Asia Minor. So anyway, it says that that these men from Asia Minor, from that area around Ephesus and all that big, larger area, Troas, all that, that they stirred up the whole crowd. They were creating a ruckus. See, Paul was just there to peacefully complete his vow. That's it, right? He wasn't there to make a stink. He was there to just do his business, take care of his vow, complete his vow, worship God in his way, and to leave. But no, he couldn't do that. Anyway, they laid hands on him, verse 28, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against this people," that is our people, the Jews, "the law and this place," the temple in Jerusalem. "And furthermore, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." Now, remember, Greeks, Gentiles, were not allowed into the temple. If you're uncircumcised, you're not allowed into the temple. All right? That was absolutely anathema. And verse 29, and here we have Luke adds sort of an explanation. He says, "For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city." Now, what this shows is that a lot of these Jews that are stirring up this problem were probably from Ephesus, all right, from the city of Ephesus, where Paul had been and spent quite a bit of time there. And so, because they recognized Trophimus, who was from Ephesus, all right, and he was a Gentile. So he was from the church in Ephesus, but he was a Gentile. And so they assumed, they saw Paul with him in the city, and now here's Paul in this huge crowd at the temple, and they assume that somewhere in the crowd is this Gentile, and so they're furious. Whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. All right, verse 30. "And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut." That is, they, you know, they, no defiled person can be in the temple. "Now, as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar." Now, keep in mind, they're at the temple. The temple was a large complex, but overseeing and overlooking this was a large Roman fort. And the Romans were, you know, they had conquered all this area, and so they had their soldiers there. And so any disturbance that took place, they got involved. They were like the police, okay? So they got involved. And so he, that is the head military, Roman military official here, it says he immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. "And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul," that is the Jews who were causing this uproar. Now they're trying to kill him and they were beating him to death. Now, you know, that's really amazing that you know, the law of Moses did allow for the death penalty for certain acts, but it was typically stoning to death. But they're not stoning Paul. They're beating him. They're beating him to a pulp to kill him. Now, is that consistent with the law of Moses? First of all, he didn't have a trial, right? And the law of Moses requires a trial. And then to be stoned if he was, you know, found guilty of a capital crime. He hasn't had a trial. They're just clubbing him. They're acting contrary to the law of Moses, the very thing that they're accusing him of doing. Isn't that amazing? The hypocrisy of it all. You know, but it's the same kind of hypocrisy that we saw when Jesus was crucified by the leadership at the temple. Same kind of hypocrisy, right? Trumped up charges and all that. All right, verse 33. Then the commander came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains, and he asked who he was and what he had done. Now, he's not. I don't believe he's asking Paul this. He's asking the crowds, you know, those who were causing the commotion. And some among the multitude cried one thing and some another. So when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken to the barracks. He's gonna separate him from the crowd, and they're going to interrogate him. All right. When he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying out, "Away with him!" Then as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" He replied, "Can you speak Greek?" Now, what's going on here? There's actually a lot of clues as to the languages that were being spoken at the time, the languages that Christians spoke, the language that Paul spoke, and so forth. Because the commander was speaking Greek, okay? That was sort of the language of trade. But not all the Jews spoke Greek. Aramaic was the language of the Jews. Now, that's true of those in Judea around Jerusalem. Those outside of Jerusalem typically didn't speak a lot of Aramaic. They spoke Greek. All right. But Paul apparently surprised this commander because he asked him, "May I speak with you?" He asked him that in Greek. And so he replied, "Can you speak Greek? Oh, you speak Greek?" And verse 38, "Are you not that Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" So he apparently there was another man who had caused a lot of trouble. And so he, excuse me, Roman official was thinking that Paul might be this same man. And so, but Paul said, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." And he wants to talk to the crowd that's trying to kill him. "So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs." So he's got an elevated platform now, because the stairs leading up to the barracks in the Roman fort there went up from the temple complex. So now he's standing up above them while he's on the stairs. And by the way, this is a large staircase, huge, had a lot of big wide stairs and it was a very high. So, you know, Paul's able to overlook the whole temple court and this enormous mob of people that are screaming and, you know, want his head. "So when he had given him permission," that is the Roman official gave Paul permission to speak to the crowd. He thought, well, maybe we can resolve this without, you know, a big riot or something. Maybe it's just a misunderstanding or something like that. So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language. Now, this is interesting. Now, a lot of people misunderstand it when the Bible says Hebrew language. It's stated several times in the Gospels, this statement, the Hebrew language. And literally, it's the language of the Hebrews. The Hebrews are the people. Jews are Hebrews. And so it's not the name of the language. It is the name of the people that speak the language. Okay? So when it says the Hebrew language or the language of the Hebrews, it means the language that the Jews were known for that was kind of unique to them as opposed to the common language of all the nations that was Greek at the time. Okay? So, you know, if you Aramaic was a strange language to people typically who spoke Greek, but not to Jews, because Jews spoke it, many Jews spoke it fluently. All right? But the reason we know that it's not the pure Hebrew language, that is the language of the Old Testament, is because in the Gospels, it uses this phrase repeatedly, and it'll say, like for example, when Jesus was on the cross, you know, he cried out, "Lama, lama, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which meant, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me?" It's the first words in Psalm 22, but Jesus, those words are not Hebrew words, they're Aramaic words. Aramaic was the ancient language of Babylon. And the Jews, when they were carried off to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, they kind of fell out of using the original Hebrew language and they picked up this Babylonian dialect. Now, the languages are very similar. And a lot of the words are the same. And but many of them are different. The alphabet is very similar. All right, but there are actually a few parts of the Bible, the Old Testament, that were written in Aramaic. There's a passage, I believe, in Jeremiah, and there's some portions of Daniel that were written in Aramaic when it's talking about, you know, something that maybe Nebuchadnezzar said or something like that, right? Because that's the language that they spoke in Babylon. And when through the Gospels, when you know, it'll say the name of a location which in the Hebrew language is blah blah blah, but when they give you that word, those words that are said to be in the Hebrew language, they're always Aramaic words, not pure Hebrew words. And so it's because of that pattern that we see in the Gospels, that whenever it uses this phrase, the Hebrew language, that it's talking about Aramaic words, that that was the case here as well. It's using the same term by Luke, who also wrote the Gospel of Luke, that when he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, he was speaking Aramaic, which was the language that the Jews used and the language that was typically used at the temple and in Judea. All right. And why would Paul, I mean, obviously he was bilingual because he addressed the Roman official in Greek, and now he's going to give his entire speech here, coming up, starting in beginning of verse chapter 22. He's going to give his entire speech to the Jews at the temple in the Aramaic language, right? The language that they typically used for worship at the synagogues, things like that. All right. So anyway, he was going to speak Aramaic. Now, I don't want to get too deep into his speech yet. We'll do that next time, okay? But I want to point out something in chapter 22, verse 1. He begins his speech by saying, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now." In other words, let me speak for myself. Now, I want you to notice the titles that he uses to address them. Brothers and fathers. Now, fathers is because, you know, I mean, you have, he's obviously talking to people, fellow Jews of his own age. And he's talking to fellow Jews that are his seniors, all right, that are much older than he is. But in both cases, he addresses them with familial terms, right? Terms that are normally used for a family. And the reason he does that is because the children of Israel right? The 12 tribes of Israel, the nation of Israel, is one big family, right? Because they all descended from one man, Jacob, whom God changed his name to Israel, right? And so they addressed these Jews, because they were descended from Jacob, they addressed each other as brother. You know, a lot of people think that it's only Christians who address each other as brother, right? And the Bible tells us to do that, actually. And sisters, of course, brothers and sisters. But this was not something unique or new. It's something that was carried over from the seed of Abraham, the descendants of Abraham, because being a descendant of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob and the 12 tribes meant that you were part of this big family. And, you know, the Jews believed that they were the recipients of the promises that God gave to Abraham, including the future ones, like the permanent land inheritance and so forth. And by using this terminology, these are loaded terms that you might miss if you're just skipping through the text, you know, just reading it as a Gentile looking at the text. But these terms are, Paul is using this kind of terminology in order to show them that he is part of them. He is what they are. He is a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, just like they are. And he does not consider himself estranged from Israel. He does not consider himself the founder of a new religion. He considers himself someone who has the same hope that they have, and that is for God to fulfill his covenant with Abraham and with David, and so forth. And so he says this. He says, let's continue reading. And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they all kept the more silent. Then he said, I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, and brought up in this city, that is in Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel. And Gamaliel was a highly respected rabbi, taught according to the strictness of our father's law. And what that essentially means is he was a Pharisee. There were basically three different sects of Judaism at the time. They were not at war with each other. They just had different beliefs about some things. And you had the more liberal sect, which was the Sadducees. And then you had the esoteric, mystical sect, which was the Essenes. And then you had the literalist, strict sect, which was the Pharisees. And so Paul is saying, look, I grew up in that. I was trained by this very highly respected rabbi. And you know, I was part of that sect that is very zealous for the law up towards God, as you all are today. And so he is acknowledging, he's actually paying them a compliment. Even though they're trying to kill him, he's paying them a compliment based on the fact that they were zealous for God's law. The problem was they were ignorant of many things regarding God's law, and they had also absorbed a lot of the traditions of the Pharisees, which Jesus condemned. You may remember back in the Gospels, read Matthew 23, but back in the Gospels, Jesus, you know, he condemned the Pharisees and said they were a bunch of hypocrites and whitewashed tombs and all this kind of stuff, that they strain in a gnat and they swallow a camel, you know, and he went on and on and on about how that they try to, you know, clean up the outside and make themselves look like they're, you know, righteous, pious people, but on the inside they're full of filth. And so, you know, he condemned them for that. There's nothing wrong with being zealous for God, but it depends on your true heart and your true motivations, because there's a lot of people who are zealous for God on the outside, and what do? They end up persecuting the righteous, those who are truly righteous, because they're not truly righteous. See, the ones who persecute the righteous have a corrupt heart. Right? So anyway, but Paul pays them a compliment regarding their being zealous to, you know, for the law of God, which even included stoning people to death if they, you know, defile the things of God. And so they're trying to, you know, they're trying to stone Paul, or they're trying to beat him to death. Now, I'm going to stop there in at the end of verse 3, because beginning in verse 4, Paul begins to give his defense. And what he does is he gives his conversion experience. You know, he starts out by saying, you know, that I was just like you. I was exactly like you. Zealous for the law, a Pharisee of the strictest sect of the Jews, and all that kind of stuff. But something profound, deeply profound, happened to me and changed me. And he had to bear witness of Christ and of his resurrection in front of these people, even though he knew it was going to really get him mad. All right, but we'll pick up his speech next time. Okay, well, it's been good to be with you, and we'll see you again next week. God bless.